recruiting partners can have a variety of different types of partners that can sort of be in play. You can have content contributors. So these can be individual scholars. These could be museums. These could be libraries. These are people who are subject specialists or who have specific content that they can give to you for your project. So, you know, Seb Chan spoke about the Cooper Hewitt Museum and their data services model. You know, the Cooper Hewitt Museum could be one of your partners because they're providing content to your project. When you think about content contributors, they basically have something to give you of some sort. It may be digital, it may be physical, but they've got something that kind of comes through. We differentiate between those people who are giving you something to use for your project and expertise contributors, who oftentimes could be non-digital. So these are your traditional humanists who don't ever want to deal with a digital humanities project, but they're subject specialists in 17th century French poetry or, you know, medieval Renaissance, whatever. These can be subject librarians who, again, aren't interested in the digital humanities element, but can provide you with resources and expertise in library and information science or their particular subject area or language of specialty. Expertise contributors are also technical partners. So they may not be giving you something physical, but they could be somebody who's created a model that you want to use or has an existing project that you want to emulate. These contributors can provide advice on what you should be doing, when, and how. So they're not necessarily going to give you anything physical for your project other than that stuff that's in their head that comes out. Oftentimes, when you think about recruiting project partners, you're looking for resource contributors. In IT, you're looking for people who can give you hardware or software or sysadmin support. Host partners, giving you physical space. You know, Myth started out, I don't know how many of you guys have ever been to the old Myth, other than the UMD people. The old Myth was 700 square feet, and we put 42 people in our conference room, built for 18. Tiny, small, dark, underground, no windows. You know, our host partners were great. The library was great, and they gave us that space. It took them 13 years to build this one. You know, so they gave us some space. They gave us some opportunities to meet. I actually answered a question about this a couple of weeks ago or last week at the MLA Commons workshop about physical space in a workshop on building a center. And one of the things that I reminded people is you don't need a custom space. You could do this at a coffee shop. You could do this at a bar. You know, you guys could meet at somebody's house to hack and code and build your project. You don't have to have something grand that's been authorized by your university. Network partners, though, on the other hand, are something you really should think about. Network partners are people who can give you access to the audience for your project. So say you're working on a project on Civil War stuff. You know, network partners could be the Southern Historical Association or SIC, the Southern Intellectual Circle. Or it could be particular departments, for example. So say in American Studies, you know, your partners could be departments in American Studies that you've sought out as sort of constituent audiences. So you notice on the back of the DHWI t-shirts, we have a series of network partners who represent sort of constituency audiences that we were looking to draw from for this. You know, so the Alliance of Digital Humanities Organizations, so digital humanists could come, libraries, the CUNY Graduate Center. You know, we were looking for network partners who could help sponsor the event and sort of promote it to their groups. So here's an example of a sort of network partnership map. This is for a project that Simon and I ran together that was designed to bring three humanities supercomputing centers, or three supercomputing centers who work in the humanities, together with digital humanists who are working in particular areas. So along the left-hand side, what you basically have are the three supercomputing centers, Pittsburgh, San Diego, and NCSA. And this grant basically identified that there were four sort of contact areas that these groups were specialized in or had sort of special expertise. High-performance computing, data grid, data analytics, and workflow and computer-assisted collaboration. And what we did to build this project was we were looking for audiences for those particular tasks or those particular things. And so what we did is we went to three different research groups that run throughout the United States, and we said, we want to partner with you as a network partner so that you can send us people who belong to your projects and in your networks to our training institutes. So the Scholarly Community for the Globalization of the Middle Ages is run out of Kalamazoo. It is a group of medievalists who work in digital humanities. They sent us, I think it was a dozen of their you know, digital humanists, medievalists to come get training. Humanistic Algorithms was a group that actually Virginia Kuhn, who is here on campus teaching this week, was running. They had, again, 2 or 3 dozen people, and they sent us 6 or 8 of them to get trained specifically in this area that work in new media. History Space, Humanities Scholars, was a team of people building 3D visualizations of historical reconstruction. And we went to them and said, send us your people because we have this issue in workflow and in high-performance computing that we want to talk about. So basically, they were sort of their window or our window into a community that we may not have been able to get a hold of otherwise. For every partner that you bring into a project, you should identify what they're going to contribute, have a clear statement of the value of the project for that partner, and you should determine the pattern of their engagement. So here's a scenario that's super useful. Say your network partner is a professional organization like the Modern Language Association. The Modern Language Association could be contributing to your project a database of every modern language scholar who's registered in their organization. You basically would write a statement to them of the value of your project, say, analyzing networks of literary scholars in the modern U.S. You would provide to them a little statement that says, this is what our project was going to do for you with the things that you're providing. And you would say how often they're going to provide it to you. Are you getting an annual database of these people? Are you getting a biannual database of these people? Are you getting a, you know, every 2 weeks you're getting updates of who's added or who's not? With every resource partner, you should think about how frequently you really want to talk to them or how frequently they're willing to talk to you. A common scenario in digital humanities that I am currently confronting is a library that will remain nameless internationally overseas, who is a full partner in a project that we can never get a hold of because it's not a priority for them. The agreement was never negotiated when the project started of how often they would deal with us. So there's a middleman, and we have to go through the middleman every time we need something new for them. So there are one-time partners. There are quarterly or monthly partners. There are daily partners. So there are people that you could be tapping every day for something new and different. When you think about one-time partners, you want to think about what that one time means. By this, I want to say, if you bring in somebody at the beginning of a project who gives you a bunch of data, but they go away as soon as they've done that, are you going to treat them the same as the person you deal with on a monthly basis? What kind of credit do they get? How often are you going to, you know, call them up and give them updates? Oftentimes, when you go from one time to quarterly or monthly to daily or to embedded, there are privileges as you move to being in the daily status. So with one time or monthly or quarterly partners, if they tend to slide on what you need from them, you don't ignore it. If a daily person kind of misses, you'll say, okay, we'll check in again tomorrow. You know, so what types of privileges do they get? Generally speaking, the matrix or the sort of mathematical equation is that the value of their contribution and the density of it, so how frequently, equals how much project authority they have. So if you deal with them more frequently, they're going to want to have more of a say in your project. If you deal with them less frequently, generally speaking, they tend to forget you exist and leave you alone. All right. So yesterday I showed you guys, when we were talking about processes of research, 2 charts. One that was sort of a traditional humanistic scholar working entirely in print media. The second was the semi-digital scholar who engaged with some digital products but wasn't really building them. This is a new matrices that I've been working on, and I think this is like the 3rd or the 4th time I've shown this, about data-centric processes in the digital humanities. So this is an example of how a collaborator or a partnership network can work in the digital humanities. So if you remember before, we sort of had this, you know, large circle that went around and, you know, the person moved from step 1 to step 2 to step 3 all on their own. In a digital humanities-based process, though, when you have lots of partnerships, you'll notice that at the top you have potentially lots of contributors who are involved in certain types of activities. So you could have some people contributing primary sources who are not contributing to the secondary source base. Or you could have contributors who sort of provide you resources to do analysis, so they give you a programmer or they're doing some coding work for you, And they have nothing to do with what the actual end products are of your project. Okay? When you think about sort of building your project team and sort of building your partners, what you want to think is, what is that unique skill that they can bring to you that you can capitalize on? And the reason why this is so important is, particularly when you're dealing with museums and libraries, they have very specific things that they are very, very, very good at. And if you build your project the right way, you can take advantage of that very, very quickly. So let's talk a little bit about this sort of diagram. What is striking about this diagram to you guys? It's a lot of secondary sources being produced. And who are they being produced from? Everyone. That's one of the unique things about a digital humanities-based project, is that potentially every single type of person on your project could be producing a secondary source work from it. So one of your reading articles that you guys had in your sort of thing to look at was an article that Simon and I co-wrote with a team of people on our Digging Into Data grant. We were graduate students working on the project. And one of the things we noticed, maybe like, I don't know, 3 weeks into the project, was that everybody was fumbling to figure out this whole structure of how we were going to collaborate internationally, because it's the first time it had ever been done. And so we were having, I don't know, beers or coffee or something, you know, doing something on a Saturday night. And we had this entire conversation about, you know, it's kind of ridiculous that we're not writing down and documenting all of the things that we had to do to make this thing work, because we needed publications. We were graduate students. We needed the CV line. It was totally crazy. And like, we sort of, you know, we're in a meeting and we said to the senior people on the project, like, hey, you know, it'd be really great if we could kind of write this stuff down. And they said, yeah, that'd be really great. I'm super focused on my article that I'm writing, though. But if you want to do it, feel free. So we actually co-authored with a team of people an entire article just about the process of the project. Other sorts of things you could sort of produce as secondary sources are code. Code counts as a product from your sort of team. You know, the visual materials. So say you want to write an analysis of the visual elements of your project and how they work. User surveys, user experience surveys can be produced as an article about how people experience your project. You know, you sort of name it, it can all be done. And Simon's going to talk specifically about the types of products that can come out of these projects. What are other things that you can notice about this matrix beyond the fact that everyone seems to be producing secondary source material?
You need three types of contributors?
You need
primary sources, analysts, and secondary sources?
Right. And so they're not necessarily always going to be the same group doing all things. So your secondary sources, your contributors, could be straight up traditional humanists that don't deal in digital media or don't deal in digital stuff at all. And you have a way of dealing with them that is different than the people that are doing your computer analysis. Other sort of things you may notice. Yeah?
All the arrows are pretty much pointing, have the same goal. And everything is really very much focused from all directions on that central point.
Exactly. So a good example of why analysis is usually sort of the central thing people work around is that the results you get from a project are results that partners can use to justify their involvement. So everybody has a constituency that they have to respond to. So in Melissa's case, you know, Melissa's working on her zine. She's a graduate student. She's got advisors that she has to, like, explain why she spent an entire week in a class doing this instead of working on whatever she was supposed to be working on for them. So one of the things that she can do is turn around and present her products from this week to them and say, this is what I accomplished. This is what I learned. And the next time Melissa wants to go to another training institute, they'll probably be more likely to let her go without having her do extra work. You know, those sorts of things. You can sort of turn around the products to people to justify getting more and more resources and more support.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, this is something that you can offer to somebody when you contact them. Like, I want your help, and in return, I plan that you can write an article?
Yep.
You get a line on your CV? Okay.
That we'll co-author. So this is a lot of how we sort of do it in the digital humanities. Very rarely are there single-authored pieces. Mostly, almost always, in the leading journals at least, they're co-authored. So a lot of times we do co-authored articles. I'll write my piece, you write your piece, and then we'll get together in a Google Doc and co-write it together, you know, whatever's left.